WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
So absolutely clear and hypnotic is Tobias Wolff's painful memoir of growing up in the 1950s that a reader wants to take it apart and find some simple way to describe why it works so beautifully. That's how Christopher Lehmann-Haupt began his New York Times review of Wolff's new book, This Boy's Life. Wolff's memoir is something of a companion piece to his brother Jeffrey's acclaimed book, The Duke of Deception, a portrait of their father who was a con man and fooled even his own children into believing he was from an aristocratic background. When Jeffrey and Tobias were children, their parents split up. Jeffrey lived with his father, Tobias with his mother. While Jeffrey was learning genteel skills and manners, how to shoot, how to read respectfully, how to box, and how to handle a boat, Tobias and his mother were virtually broke. Jeffrey's memoir is about discovering his father was a fraud. Tobias's memoir is about traveling west with a loving mother who wanted to make a new life, but kept ending up with abusive men. Tobias Wolff won a 1985 Penn Faulkner Award for his short novel, The Barracks Thief. I wanted to know if Jeffrey's book, The Duke of Deception, inspired Tobias to write his new memoir.
Not really. In fact, my tendency was to avoid the idea of writing a memoir because he had written one originally. I thought, well, you know, what's to be said here? But in fact, we had completely different lives. He grew up in the East. I grew up in the West. He grew up in rather privileged circumstances, and I did not. We grew up in different classes, really, and had lost touch with each other, in fact, for many, many years. So I had a completely different story to tell.
How did it come to be that you went with your mother and he went with your father when your parents separated?
Well, when our parents were divorced, we were each given a choice as to who to go with. And I was very young at the time, and it wasn't much of a choice anyway. I hardly knew my father, and I never did get to know him very well. But, of course, I stayed with my mother, and my brother was very attached to my father and went with him.
What was the experience like for you of reading your brother's book, The Duke of Deception, which really told about all the lies your father had created over the years, the fake history of himself that he had made up?
It was not a surprise, of course, because my brother and I are very close, and we have and I did indeed get to know my father later on in my life. We had talked about all these things before. I thought it was brilliantly written, a very moving book about his life with my father. It was a book mostly about my father. When I came to write my own memoir, it was. I have young boys, and what was beginning to interest me was just the whole question of growing up and how you make a self, how you decide who you are, and that's what my book is about. It's really more about my own growing up, and it's my mother is a very strong figure in the book, as she was in my life and is in my life. But the concentration of my book is on this process of growing up.
Let me ask you to read the very beginning of your new memoir, This Boy's Life.
Good. Our car boiled over again just after my mother and I crossed the Continental Divide. While we were waiting for it to cool, we heard, from somewhere above us, the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past us into the next curve, its trailer shimmying wildly. We stared after it. "Oh, Toby," my mother said. "He's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, and faded in the wind that sighed in the trees all around us. By the time we got there, quite a few people were standing along the cliff where the truck went over. It had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. It looked pitifully small. A stream of thick black smoke rose from the cab, feathering out in the wind. My mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident. Someone had. We stood with the others at the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. My mother put her arm around my shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at me, touching me, brushing back my hair. I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs. I knew she had no money for them. and I had tried not to ask, but now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable, tooled leather saddle. It was 1955, and we were driving from Florida to Utah to get away from a man my mother was afraid of and to get rich on uranium. We were going to change our luck.
One of the things I really like about that beginning is the sense of disaster can happen at any second. A trunk could just lose its brakes and go over the cliff. And your mother's going to try to be a good mother, and you're going to be a kid. I mean, it's just out of control. You're a kid. You're going to manipulate her to get that souvenir.
That's right. Yeah. It's an emblem of the book, in a way, that episode. We still talk about that episode. It made such an indelible impression on us. But
why? Why did it?
Well, we were so full of hope and going to this new life, and just for a moment there, we were too foolish for our optimism ever to get dampened for long, but just for a moment there, we tasted it, you know. We tasted our mortality, and we tasted the vanity of our hopes, seeing this man who probably was very hopeful himself about getting home for dinner that night, finishing his run, suddenly have everything go wrong on him. And I've never forgotten it. I can still see his face in the windshield.
You talked about how this memoir for you is really about coming of age, finding out who you are, who you want to be, and trying to become that. Your father transformed himself through lying, through making up a false history, through making up lineage that he didn't have, through even lying about his furniture and where that came from, making things into antiques that weren't.
Right.
Your mother wanted to transform herself and wanted to change her luck, but the way she ended up actually taking action was to hook up with different men.
Yes.
And all of those men ended up being disasters. They abused both your mother and you. And she seemed to really be unaware that that was going to happen each time she'd meet a new man. But you seemed to always know.
No, I didn't always know this was going to happen until it happened. I in a sense conspired in this by not learning my lesson either. We went from one man like this to another. It's true. But I think that what's more important than this is what we made of these situations. I mean, it's true that we drifted into these rather violent and frightening situations sometimes together, but we always kept faith with each other, and we kept our pluck, and we changed our luck again and again. We reinvented the circumstances. We'd go somewhere else and try again, and eventually, oddly enough, we were right. It worked. We both translated ourselves to different people and to better lives.
When you were young and you were in the Boy Scouts, you'd like to really read the Boy Scouts magazine, Boy's Life.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that really appeal to you? Your life was very different from the kind of mainstream view of what a Boy Scout should be, the good and healthy, wholesome life.
Yeah, that's right. I think that when I was reading it, I fell into a kind of spell in which I believed I was those boys that the magazine was about, these boys who saved lives and had trap lines in the Arctic, and boys who built airplanes in their backyards and flew them at state fairs, these extraordinary young entrepreneurs. And while I was reading this magazine, I felt like I was participating in this ideal American boyhood that all the movies I went to and the television shows and the radio shows that I listened to sort of invited us all to believe we were living. And there's a strange disjunction that happens with children in this country between the ideal childhood that's proposed to them. We're a culture that has a kind of worship of children and childhood, and yet people don't really live those lives. So they look at them from a distance with kind of worshipful eyes and pretend they're living them. Yeah, so that magazine was very, very important to me in that way when I was young. That's why I called this memoir of mine "This Boy's Life." It's to distinguish between that ideal boyhood of the, you know, of Norman Rockwell, the kind of pictures that Norman Rockwell would draw of young of childhood, and the kind that I and in fact most of the boys I knew when I was growing up actually lived.
You really wanted to have a conventional life and a conventional family.
Sure. Sure. I think it's a real cycle. I think that children who grow up in safe, secure, conventional, middle-class families all want to become outlaws and right. rebels and live in dirty apartments and never do the dishes. And children who grow up chaotically and poverty and who have no automatic hold on respectability in the world come to prize conventionality and security. Yes, that's what I wanted when I don't want it so much anymore, I think, but I sure did want it when I was a boy.
Your mother wanted a good family that spent time together also, and I really like what you write about that. You say, mother insisted we spend time together like a real family. Our failure was ordained because the real family we set out to imitate doesn't exist in nature. A real family as troubled as ours would never dream of spending time together.
That's right. Yeah, I'd forgotten that line. That's right.
But how much of that charade did you go through?
Well, we had our rich. This was the life I led with my first stepfather and his family, and that we led with them, and we did. We had these rituals of family life, and they were they gave us for a little while the appearance, and we actually probably believed that we were a real family when we would sit together and watch Lawrence Welk. I can't think hear the name today without wilting. Mitch something in the sing-along
game. Mitch
gang.
Miller.
Mitch Miller. He used to make us watch Mitch Miller. We'd all sit around. That was our idea of a family evening, is sitting in front of the tube and watching Lawrence Welk and Mitch Miller. And he, stepfather would get his old saxophone out and sit there oh, Lord. Don't make me relive it again.
I don't know. You've just been through it in your book, although you left out that particular story.
The Mitch Miller one I did, I left out, but I've got Lawrence Welk in there all right.
Right. Tobias Wolff is my guest, and his new memoir is called This Boy's Life. There's a scene that you describe, one of the father figures in your life, one of the men that your mother had hooked up with for a while, gave you a Winchester, a rifle, and one day you were leaning out the window, aiming the rifle out the window, pointing at a couple who were walking by, and you pulled the trigger and actually didn't shoot the couple, you shot a squirrel. But in describing that scene, in reading that scene, I couldn't help but wonder whether, looking back, you think you were ever on the verge of really becoming one of those neighbors next door who goes nuts and kills somebody?
Well, in a way, I guess the point of that scene is that anybody can become someone like that almost inadvertently. It's funny, my friends, when they've read that section, the men, not the women, have almost all said to me, I was not aiming the rifle at these people when I pulled the trigger. I was aiming at something else. But it is true that I used to aim the rifle out the window at people walking past. And every boy I know who grew up in a house where there were weapons did things like that. They've all told me that. It is a very typical thing. What do you think kids do with those things? They watch when the things we watch in the movies and TV kind of take away our sense of mortality, that, you know, that things don't have consequences when you point guns at people. There, you'll see them next week on another show. And we have an infatuation in this country with firearms and handling them. And boys left alone in a house, I think girls are not so interested in them, but boys left alone in a house with a weapon are going to get that weapon out and they're going to point it.
Your memoir, This Boy's Life, is about how you invented and reinvented yourself, and perhaps the most stunning reinvention of yourself that you're responsible for is how you got into prep school. Just to explain here, although your father had for a while been rich, your mother, who you were with, was always poor. And when you were in, I guess it was junior high school, you and your brother started communicating, and your brother urged you to try to get away from your father, your stepfather, who was beating you, and try to get into prep school, and he said he'd try to help you. So you got really hooked on the idea and tried to get a scholarship. So what you did was you made up letters of recommendations from all of your teachers, and you tried to really write it in their tone of voice. And you wrote, "And on the boy who lived in their letters, the splendid phantom who carried all my hopes, it seemed to me at last I saw my own face." And I thought that's so convincing that you were really, truly writing letters about the boy who you think you were or deserved to be as a boy, as opposed to the boy who you were forced to become.
Right. Yeah. Well, we all have a kind of dream self. And in making, in writing those, my actual self, I'm afraid, wasn't quite the boy that I portrayed in those letters. I was a very indifferent student in a very bad school, and lazy, and I didn't even go to school a lot of the time. I hung out with a bad bunch, and I mean, they were actually good guys, really looking back on it, but they were a, they were considered a bad bunch then, and I was no model of American boyhood, and to get into this, to get not just to get in, I had to get a scholarship to this prep school, and it was quite clear to me that being the boy I was, in fact, was not going to get me in. I couldn't even get a letter of recommendation from my teachers, so I decided to take this task on myself. What did I have to lose, right? I'd end up, if I lost, being where I was. So I basically wrote down in these letters of recommendation that I made up a picture of the boy that I dreamed I really was if everybody just knew me actually, as well as I knew myself. And you know, the straight-A student, the Eagle Scout, upright fellow, and manufactured this identity and did it, I guess, persuasively enough, since I did get it. a scholarship to a fine prep school, which changed my life completely.
Did you do a convincing job of reinventing yourself at prep school because you had to pretend to be the boy who you had described in these letters, the boy who got you into this school?
No, it didn't hold up very well. For one thing, coming from such a lousy school as I was coming from, and not having been a good student at that school anyway, I didn't know very much. I was very ignorant, and my teachers were puzzled at how little I knew considering the brilliant transcripts that came in. I had a friend in the school office at that school who gave me the school transcript form, so I made out my own grades, and I awarded myself straight A's and in courses that I hadn't even taken in order to get in. So I didn't know very much. I had a terrible time academically at the school, but an English teacher there took me under his wing and tutored me and gave me books, and I was excited about reading anyway, but he taught me to be a systematic and careful reader, and he excited me about writing, as indeed my brother had also, and really brought me along. It was the pivotal experience of my life being at that school and being under that man's tutelage. And I owe, you know, just all kinds of things to him for that. So it turned out to be a wonderful, almost fairy tale escape for me. And I loved the school, but no, the act didn't hold up. And eventually it fell apart, and I was in my senior year there, in my last year, my sixth form year, I was asked to leave.
Tobias Wolff, we were just talking about how you lied your way into prep school but eventually got thrown out. Do you believe in lying when it's the only way to get what you need and when you know that ultimately you're not telling a terrible mistruth, that it won't be a malicious mistruth?
Well, on the one hand, as a writer, I'm committed to truth. I mean, in this book about a boy who lies, I am very scrupulous in telling the truth, and the book is in a lot of ways about the cost of not telling the truth. So no, ultimately I think lies subtract from your substance as a person, and the more of them you tell, the more you beggar yourself. But I will distinguish between lying and invention, and especially self-invention. Children need to try on different selves. They don't know who they are. They try different things. You'll see the way kids change their hair constantly, you know, their hairdos, and experiment with their clothes and all that. It's really all sort of fumbling around trying to figure out who they are. And so there's a period when you're young when I think especially parents have to be very careful not to apply standards about lying to what is naturally occurring in the child's life in terms of just figuring out who they are and trying on different selves. And sometimes that involves acts of self-invention. And I think that, you know, that we have to be very tolerant about that.
Even when you're trying very hard to tell the truth, there are so many different versions of the truth. Did you run into that when writing this memoir? I think you gave the manuscript to your mother and to your brother and to others to read before
Yes,
it was published.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to be sure that when it came out, they wouldn't say, oh, no, this is, not to others, but to me, you've got it all wrong. And I was very gratified that they were very impressed by the accuracy of the record, and that it really squared with their own recollections. My mother had some questions about chronology. She has a wonderful kind of memory, and she says, here and there, I got things switched around and whatnot, but nothing serious at all. And basically, I let those things stand, because that's the way I remembered them, and that's the story I'm telling, is what my memory tells me. You can follow someone around with a camera and a notebook and a tape recorder, and you'll get a lot of facts, but you won't get the truth. The truth lies in the memory, and because that's the story you tell yourself about who you are and where you come from, where you've been. And so I was very attentive to my memory and trusted that.
You and your brother have both written memoirs about your childhood. You've read each other's books, and you've become very close over the years, even though you were separated from each other during childhood.
Maybe that's why we're close.
Did you ever go through a period of envying each other's lives? Did you ever wish you'd stayed with your father? Did your father ever wish he'd stayed with your mother? Did he ever wish he was poor, like you were often poor? Did you ever wish that you had money like he did?
I can't speak for him. I don't think that he ever wished to be poor. I don't think anybody ever wished to be poor. But I certainly spent a lot of time wishing I was rich. And my father was a very charismatic guy. Though I hardly knew him, I remembered him well. I could remember the sort of tobacco smell that used to cling to his tweeds. He had a deep, grumbling voice, and he was big and had a very bearish kind of presence. And I remember lying in my bed at night and hearing his voice come through the bedroom wall, that rumble of his, and I'd how secure I'd feel hearing that. So there were, you know, I longed to be with my father, not to be with my mother, but to be with my father also. And I romanticized him and idealized him to an extraordinary degree, as you do with an absent parent. When the parent is there and you experience the humanity of that and the flaws and natural difficulty of living with another person from day to day, you can't do that. But children who are separated for years and years from their parents without seeing them, oddly enough, develop very, very idealized notions of them, and I certainly did with my father.
We were talking about lies before. What was the most damaging lie that your father told you?
It wasn't so much lies he told me, but truths that he did not tell me. I was led to believe by him that we came from an aristocratic family, and that he had coats of arms and all this, and my mother was Irish Catholic. I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and he objected to this. He said his family had always been Episcopalians and everything. Well, it turned out my father's family were a wonderful Jewish family of doctors and brilliant surgeons with their own claim to respect and stature, which he and some he didn't want to be Jewish, and he cut my brother and I off not only from that knowledge but from the knowledge of that of his wonderful family because he didn't want us to understand this about him and consequently about ourselves. And so we lost that half of our family, and when my brother went back to write about my father and interviewed these people, they were wonderful people. And it broke our hearts that we had been denied their company when we were growing up and the richness of that life that they had in Hartford. So, you know, his lies had terrible, terrible consequences on us, as his absence did on me. That's partly what this book is about. I don't romanticize lying in this book. I talk about self-invention. I talk about lies, and the lies, you know, the big lies in this book cause inestimable harm.
You said earlier that when you were young, you really wanted a conventional family, but you implied you don't really feel exactly that way now.
Well, in some ways I do. I mean, but
I should say here that I think you're married and have two children. Is
oh
that right?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think what it is is that kind of hankering for respectability that children have, who feel that in some way or other they aren't respectable. And that's what I was talking about. I mean, I just don't go around worrying about that very much anymore. I don't care all that much anymore what people think of me. I do care a lot about what they think of my work, I'm less vulnerable to the opinion of others than I was when I was a boy.
This is, I believe, the first really autobiographical thing that you've written. You've written stories about other people, and they are indirectly autobiographical, but this is direct autobiography.
Yes,
do you feel do you feel exposed by it? What's the experience been for you?
Yes, I do. In the past, when people are, as I say, the way we're talking right now, if I'm being interviewed about a collection of stories or a novel that I've written, people will talk about the characters, and it's quite clear these are characters, these are inventions, even though obviously they may spring from some origin in my life. We're talking about figures in a book. And now when we're talking about this book, you know, clearly we're talking about me, or at least my idea of who I am and the people I've known. And yes, I do feel vulnerable. I think I'd be crazy if I didn't.
But is that an acceptable feeling to you? I mean, will you continue to write directly about yourself?
Probably not, but not because I'm afraid of that feeling. No, this wasn't the first installment in a series of memoirs, such as, say, Jimmy Carter might write about the landscape of his life and the great figures he's known and the Camp David Accords. I mean, it's not like that. I just found something. I've always thought that that those events that I recount in this book had a very interesting, almost novelistic shape to them. And have been wanting to write the story for years about growing up. It's really about the experience of growing up in this country, being kind of outside the circle of privilege, but wanting in badly, and what you'll do to get there.
One last thing. Do you think that your writing changed at all, that the voice you used was different because you were writing in first person?
Yes. Yes, it was, dear. It's a little fuller. I tend to have I think it's a warmer voice. It tends to be I tended to really pull out the stops when I wrote this. I just imagined talking to a great friend, you know, when I was writing this book, and let it rip.
You're going to do that the next time you write something? Imagine that you're talking to a great friend?
Yes, probably so. I enjoy using the voice in this, and I don't know what I'm writing stories again now, and I don't know what they're going to be like in the end.